To begin by joining Xiaogang and thanking Alyosha, I guess he's not here, for organizing a great conference. Really learned a lot. Okay, so I'm going to use a laser pointer. I presume that's allowed in Canada. Right. Okay. Okay, this should work. There we go. So I should mention we've already met Cheng Keizhu and Max Matwiski, and most of my talk will actually relate to their ideas and recent work with them. And I'll also mention some work with Yuvuk Moon, another student at Harvard. So we've heard many examples in this meeting of spin liquid states. There's been very nice talks by Xiaogang, Matthew Fisher, Yong-Baek Kim. But the spin liquids they've all talked about are all in a particular class. And I'm going to introduce a different class of possible spin liquid states. And these have a different motivation. They arise from looking at starting from some magnetically ordered state and then asking in a semi-classical manner initially of how you might lose the magnetic order. So I'll review some of the work in that direction. And then in part two, which is a bit of an interlude, I'll show you how these the other types of spin liquids that others have talked about and these types of spin liquids can all be unified in some recent work with Cheng Keizhu in a common formalism where Majorana or fermions play a fundamental role. And then in the last part of my talk, I'll again continue the discussion of how you lose magnetic order, but not in an insulator, but in a metal. So this will be, and I believe some of this has direct applications to experiments on the cuprates, but okay, that will not excite most people here. Sorry. Okay, so let me begin by talking about this somewhat different perspective on spin liquid states or topologically ordered state by starting from a semi-classical theory of states with magnetic order. And here the motivation, of course, is that almost every material or spin system that you take has magnetic order. Those are the ones that don't are the rare ones. So let's work in the region of phase space near the ones that are found. And of course, the most familiar example is lanthanum copper oxide, which is a square lattice antiferromagnet and has this kind of nail order where half the spins point up and the other half point down. And this is known to be the ground state even for spin a half. And there's a vector order parameter which I'll call phi, which measures this broken symmetry. And phi in the classical system would be one half, but here it's about 30% smaller. But the important point is it's non-zero. So given the square lattice antiferromagnet, now the idea is, well, let's add a few more perturbations. And the hope is that if the perturbations are large enough, that you will smoothly connect eventually across some phase transition to a state without magnetic, without nail order. And we want to know what are those states and can you classify such states. So if I was doing this sort of question has a long history in classical physics where there is a well-developed method for attacking it. And the basic idea, roughly speaking, is as follows. You start with your ordered state, and then you allow it to fluctuate. So you, here in this case, the ordered state breaks rotational symmetry, spin rotations. So you introduce some rotation matrix R, and for future use, I've written as an SU2 matrix in terms of field Z. You allow this to fluctuate in space and time. And then you write down a theory for this rotation matrix. So this is in the spirit of, in particle physics, of the chiral symmetry breaking and the confined phase of QCD, this is roughly what you do. So the content of the Ginzburg-Landau approach that the net matter physicists use is that, well, you just use some basic symmetries to write down an effective theory for this fluctuating order parameter or this equivalent to this vector field phi. Now, of course, the most important point is that this whole approach fails here, and this order parameter description is inadequate. And one way to think about it is that, you know, you're thinking of the system in terms of fluctuation of some scalar field giving the local orientation of the ground state, but there's also the electrons. There are electrons sitting there, one electron per site in that mod insulator. And so the charge excitation of the electrons are gapped. So in some sense, the electrons are occupying fully filled states. But nevertheless, they're still important. And the way they become important here is that when you take defects in your order parameter, depending on the precise ordered state, it could be point defects called hedgehogs. So they're basically a singular point where the spins point radially outwards. Or in some more some other ordered state, they could be vortices. That these defects acquire quantum mechanical phase factors. And these phase factors are extremely important because they lead to additional degeneracies of the defects and non-trivial properties under the lattice space group. And all of this then turns out to be crucial in understanding the structure of the quantum disordered phase. Okay, so that's the basic idea, and I'm just going to give you a review of the kind of results that follow from accounting for these Berry phase terms associated with the defect in the classical auto parameter field. So these have all been understood and worked out by a very different method over the years, but I'll give you a sort of a new perspective on it today, which actually connects to the previous talks on the physics of the quantum spin Hall effect, although this was not the way these things were understood originally. Anyway, so let's talking about the square lattice antiferromagnet. Let's go back to free electrons. So free electrons have some simple band structure. There's one electron per site, so their band is only half filled. And let's say if you take this as the band structure for the electrons and the cuprates, so the states here are filled and the states there are empty. So that's what free electrons look like. And now, of course, that's not the state that you get in lanthanum copper oxide. But I'll just take a very simplistic band perspective. And I will say, well, the reason you don't get that is because, of course, you have magnetic order. So if I assume add magnetic order to this band structure, what do I get? So that's an exercise in simple solid-state physics. And let me just quickly review the analysis. So you take your order parameter phi, and it has momentum k, which is pi pi, because the spin orientation oscillated from site to site. So it'll scatter. Oops, there should be a dagger there. It'll scatter your fermion by momentum k with a spin Pauli matrix here. Now, if phi is a constant, then your Hamiltonian is extremely simple. It's your free electrons plus this scattering term. And if you scatter twice, you come back to the same k because k is pi pi. So you just have to diagonalize a 2x2 matrix. This is what you get. And then you fill the lowest energy states. So if you do this for that particular band structure, then this is the original band structure. If you move everything by momentum capital K, this is the new Fermi surface that you get. And then you see that you get these special spots called hotspots where both the initial and final state before and after the scattering by momentum K are on the Fermi surface. And so that's where the diagonal terms are zero and the 2x2 matrix opens up a gap. And so you open up gaps in the Fermi surface, and you end up getting then pockets, Fermi pockets, one of which has, no states occupied. These are called hole pockets here, and these are electron pockets depending on the number of fermion bands that are occupied. So most of the band, one band is, two bands are occupied there and zero here, and I've got it wrong. Here there's one band that's fully occupied, here there's zero bands occupied, and here there's two bands occupied. Anyway, but that's not the state I'm interested in. The only reason I've introduced this is because I need it later when I talk about metals. In the insulator, this is the world's simplest band structure. There's nothing. There's just only fully filled bands and no Fermi surface. So that's the Néel state I began with. So this state I thought of as just having some broken symmetry with spins pointing up and down. But here I have to also remember that there's a filled band of electrons sitting there. With no Fermi surface around it. So here's another picture of what I want to do. So I initially introduced this SU2 matrix to rotate the Néel state. And that was just acting on some abstract state sitting there with this defined by the orientation of the spins. But now instead of thinking of that in an abstract state, I think of that as actually a state of electrons. So this is the state that you get where you have some filled band and an empty band. By doing this very simple band structure. And so that's the Hartree-Fock mean field theory, just these field bands of these electrons that I'm momentarily calling psi plus and psi minus. And then to get to now to rotate it, to allow things to fluctuate, I multiply this field bands, this state, by an SC2 matrix. And this operator, this then tells us then, if you wish, the fractionalization of the electron. These are the full electron operators. This is telling you the local orientation of the spin density wave on the nail state. And plus and minus are the spin indices in the local rotating reference frame. So they're not true spin indices. They're just the spin indices and what the local nail order happens to be. And so instead of working with the original electron to describe a fluctuating state where the nail order is fluctuating, I won't allow the Z to fluctuate and maybe even average to zero. And then I'll be left with these new types of particles which don't carry a spin index. So if I want to write down a theory then for the fluctuating nail state, where this nail order is fluctuating, I'll use the Z's and the psi's. So this is again, to remind you, the Z's are telling you the local orientation of the order, and the psi's are the spin indices that are fermions that carry, whose indices tell you whether they spin up or down relative to the local order. Anyway, so one general feature of this theory, once you do this factorization, is that there is, at the moment, just a focus on the U1 gauge invariance. In fact, there's a larger gauge invariance. So you notice that if I rotate the Z's by a phase factor, e to the I theta, and psi plus or minus this way, nothing changes on the in this entire expression. And so there is a U1 gauge invariance here. And so the theory then must be a U1 gauge theory. And what is the matter in this U1 gauge theory? Well, there are these Z's, which are telling you, which are bosons, and they are, I call them spinons because they carry a spin index. And if you also ask how the electromagnetic field acts on it, on these particles, is basically these psi plus and psi minus have the same charge as the electron. So they are neutral with respect to, when I say neutral, I mean neutral with respect to physical electromagnetism. They, of course, carry charge 1 in this U1 emergent gauge field. And these fermions are spinless, but they have the charge, meaning the charge of the physical electromagnetic field. Now, normally, in the classical picture, you would say these are not important because they occupy some filled band. But we still have to keep them for a little bit, as you see. And then the U1 gauge field. So with these constraints, you can write down some effective action for these degrees of freedom, but I won't do that. We don't really need it. We will in a minute, but then I'll write it down. So what is the state we began with? The state we began with in this language is just the Higgs state, where the Z is condensed. You have some definite orientation, and that's the nail state. Now you want Z to fluctuate. And you're going to get some other state where you don't have nail order, and you've got to know what that state is. So that's really the state where Z's are gapped. So let's assume that the Z excitations are initially free, and they acquire some high-energy gap, and so I can look at the rest of the excitations. Well, as first guess, you'd say, well, the only thing left is the photon, and the photon will have some initially could be in a Coulomb phase, but then there are confinement effects you have to worry about. But in addition to that, there are also topological effects. And so let's focus on the photon. Now, the photon will also couple to the fermion psi. Now, in general, the way the photons couple to the fermion psi is kind of complicated, depends on the entire band structure and so on. And there are various ways of working it out. But things become very simple on the honeycomb lattice. So here, in the spirit of the previous talk, Andreas, you know, there's a very complicated UV of the lattice in general, but in some lattices, like the honeycomb lattice, you can relatively easily go to Dirac fermions. So let me just do that here. So you get some theory of some number of species of Dirac fermions, massive Dirac fermions, and all these Pauli matrices here, rho and sigma, are actually extremely important, and they just depend on the band structure. And this whole thing is time reversal invariant because spin rotation symmetry has been restored. So you have a bunch of Dirac fermions with massive Dirac fermions coupled to this U1 gauge field. So that, you would say, is the low energy theory for this insulator where you've lost the nail order. Yeah.
So the vector field here Is this CP1 type vector field, the internal?
This AMU?
It's not electromagnetic.
That's right. This is the CP1. This is the emergent gauge field.
Okay.
Over here. Right.
Okay. Yeah. And the sigma act on the flavors or species?
Yeah, sigma z is actually, in this case, it just acts in this plus minus index.
Okay, you said that you also have the doublers of the honeycomb lattice.
Yeah, and species. That's the row.
Thank and you. That's the row.
That's okay. The row.
Right. Right. I need to keep track of that.
Yeah, well, okay. And then there's also a sublattice index which has gone in the gamma matrices.
Okay.
Okay, the size of, like, the age of that thing.
Okay.
Okay, so that's the low energy theory for the fermions. Now, just for fun, I'm going to add, since, now ultimately, you know, where do I want to go with this? Well, ultimately, I have the only low energy mode I'm going to get is a photon. But that photon in 2 plus 1 is a compact U1 photon, and we know it undergoes confinement. And that confinement process proceeds by condensation of monopoles. That's Polyakov's theory of confinement in 2 plus 1 QED. So we need to know something about those monopoles. So, and that's what I'm just going to briefly describe. So just for fun, I'm going to couple in very cleverly an external source field I call V mu. And this is just going to teach me something about the fate of the photon. And of course, I've chosen this cleverly so that this polymatrix times that polymatrix gives me this polymatrix. And some of you will recognize that that's exactly what's needed to get the quantum spin-Hall effect in 1 plus 1 dimension, not the 2 plus 1 dimensional case that, sorry, in 2 plus 1 dimension, not the 3 plus 1 dimensional case that Andreas just talked about. So in particular, in the usual quantum spin-Hall effect, say in something like graphene, and then A mu would be the physical electromagnetism, and B mu would be something coupling to the spin current in that case. Anyway, so if you don't know that, don't worry about it. So we just, as a particle theory, if you look at this theory, integrate out psi. If you integrate out psi for this particular theory, which preserves time and Wilson invariance, what you'll get as a low energy theory is this Chern-Simons term with a specific coefficient, which is a cross Chern-Simons term coupling these two gauge fields A to B. Okay, and this is also in some version the physics of the quantum spin-Hall effect in 2 plus 1 dimension. And there, as I think Chengke Zhu discussed this, when you apply an electric field, you get a spin current. Here, what this tells us is that if I change the AMU flux that introduces the analog of the electric field, I'm going to get an accumulate spin, and that's a B mu charge. Now, where do I change the AMU flux in this theory? Well, that's what a monopole in this gauge field is. You introduce 2 pi flux in AMU. That monopole, therefore, carries B mu charge. So that's one of the most important things that comes out of here. And this is very general. We know this happens on many lattices without ever referring to Dirac fermions. They've been computed in very other ways without any connection to the quantum spin-Hall effect, but it's kind of, we've been really pleased to see that the same physics can be recast in this language too. Anyway, so this is the main thing this whole song and dance was about. Was to show you that these field Baryonic fermions lead to non-trivial crystal momentum properties and other degeneracies of defects, in particular a defect which is a monopole in this gauge field, which in fact becomes a hedgehog in the original male order parameter. Okay. So there's many years of work then on understanding what the effect of these quantum numbers in the monopole is on the corner on the state where the Nayer order is fluctuating. And I certainly won't go through it. I just list some of the phases and results that you've gotten in the hope that perhaps, especially people in the working on tensor networks and others on models will be able to see if any of these predictions actually work and what classes of spin models do realize some of the states you get by this approach. Okay, so the one basic result that you do get from here is if you start the model that I started with, this Nayer order allowed to fluctuate, the most natural state where the monopoles condense is this valence bond solid. So, and the appearance of valence bond solid order here is directly connected then to this fact that the monopoles in AMU carry this new charge, and that new charge is related to this matrix rho y. And you can see from that, since rho y connects the two valleys of the honeycomb lattice, why the monopole now carries a momentum, which basically takes you from one value to the other, and that's related to the appearance of the valence bond solid, the broken translational symmetry. Okay, so there's a valence bond solid, and you know, there are certainly some models, the Sandvik model in particular, where this kind of state has been very well established next to the Nail state. There's a lot of work on what the nature of this transition is, and that's not a fully settled issue, which I won't discuss any further, but it seems clear that it's almost second order, if not exactly second order. Okay, so this kind of thing can be generalized to more complicated models, models with frustration, stronger frustration, and one way in this approach you'd want to do that is simply first look at the effect of frustration on the ordered state, and then think about the defects in the ordered state, what are the quantum numbers carried by the defects, and then you figure out what you get. So Chenke Zhu and I and others have worked on this in quite a while. So this is this is a different lattice. This is the Nail to the valence bond solid that I just discussed. Now, if you put frustration on the square lattice or this sort of triangular lattice, you can get another type of state. This is a spiral state. So here, the spins are oscillating in some direction. And this is also a state, even just in the classical spin analysis, can show you what kind of state you're going to get from here. And then you can do the same sort of, now you allow this to fluctuate quantum mechanically. What do you get? I won't go through that, but through a similar sort of reasoning, you get a different type. In this case, you actually end up getting a true spin liquid with no broken symmetry, and that's obtained by quantum disordering this spiral state. And in fact, in this language, we studied the properties of this spin liquid state, I guess now almost 20 years ago. And what we came up with was a state with a four-fold degeneracy on a torus, which had gapped excitations, which are now called spinons and visons, which have mutual semion statistics. And this is, in the end, it's the same basic structure, modulo some additional degeneracies and quantum numbers of the toric code. So the beautiful Kitaev model, which came much later, gave an exact realization of the same physics that was, I believe, pretty clear to us even at this time. Furthermore, also, there's an interesting multi-critical point that appears in this particular approach taken by Chenke Zhu and myself. And this turns out to be described by a double Chun-Simons theory which doesn't break time reversal. And it's actually, for the string theorists, it's a quite closely a non-supersymmetric analog in many respects of the ABGM model. And that's similar to this multi-critical point with these four different phases meeting at a point. Okay. Now, so all of this approach, you know, is rather field theoretical, but we've also taken a bunch of mean field calculations using the Schwinger-Boson approach, and then systematically looking at fluctuations in the 1 over n expansion. And I'll just flash a few phase diagrams to give you a flavor of the kind of phases you get. So here's the prediction for square lattice antiferromagnet with first and second neighbor exchange, so meaning just nearest neighbor exchange J1 and diagonal exchange J2. So that's J2 over J1. And the vertical axis is 1 over S. That's the length of the spin. So S equals infinity is down here. That's the classical regime. And classically, you get this Nail order at pi pi, and then you get a somewhat a different Nail order state at 0 pi, and these are, of course, extremely well established. And then as you decrease S, somewhere there's a transition without frustration to the valence bond solid that I've already discussed on this axis. Now, precisely where this happens, of course, we have, you know, is not particularly accurate in this mean field theory. But at some value of S, then you would get, and the fact that this is line is an artifact. The fact that this is horizontal is, of course, an artifact of the mean field. But this is the basic general structure you get. And in addition to the Nail order state, then you have this valence bond solid of different patterns appearing at smaller values of S when quantum fluctuations increase. Then if you put in the third neighbor coupling, J3, then in addition to these Nail and VVS states, you get the spiral states that I've talked about. And only in a relatively small region of the phase diagram, you get spin liquids in between. although they do become larger when you at certain other values of J3. Anyway, so these are the basic phases you get with this approach. All magnetic order, valence bond solids, and in some small regime, a particular type of spin liquid that's not so different from the toric code of KTF. And also, you get some realization of these multi-critical points that I mentioned earlier. Okay, so that's a lightning summary of some very old and some recent work, things I've spent many years of my life on. But anyway, so the basic idea is very simple. Just do a semi-classical theory of quantum fluctuations, but pay close attention to the topological quantum numbers that are associated with the defects in the magnetic order. And that pretty much gives you almost a complete picture of what happens. Okay. Any questions there?
Yeah. So what happens with the monopoles in the Z2 phase? Like you talked about the bison?
Yeah, so the monopoles are suppressed because there's a Higgs field that gaps out the... So the way you get a Z2 field in the gauge theory language, you get a charge to Higgs field that condenses. And so that means that the monopoles which carry... It's like putting monopoles in a superconductor. The magnetic flux of the monopoles just goes in a tube and the monopoles are not able to proliferate. So this is a mechanism actually goes back to a famous work of Fradkin and Schenker, showing you how in a charge to Higgs field you can get a deconfined phase. And you sort of realize that here too.
Yeah. In the language of the ABJM model, right. What's the two-dimensional space of perturbations that's moving you around in your phase diagram?
Okay, these are just phenomenological parameters here. Whoops, S, Z, and S, V. But roughly speaking, the Z is a spin-on mass, so there's two scalar fields. And these are the masses of the two scalar fields. And the scalar fields are coupled to two different U1 fields, and the U1 fields
have
Okay. Yeah. So one is the bison mass, and the other the spin-on mass, and they're both bosons in this approach. There are no fermions here, so it's... But anyway, it's conformal. We believe, and you can do a one-to-one expansion.
Sorry, you go with the language. The spinons and bisons, one couples to one Chern-Simons field, and the other to the other?
Each of them have separate gauge field, and there is a mutual Chern-Simons term between them.
Okay, the A field is spin on, the B is bison.
Right? Well, there's different ways of, so at least for the U1 case, the non-abelian ABJM has two non-abelian gauge fields with Chern-Simons terms of opposite parity.
Okay.
If you were U1, you can take the sum and difference of the gauge fields and convert that to a mutual sensor. Or if you want to take that language, the bison has charge 1-1 and the spin-on has charge 1-1. That also the same pattern that comes up here. That's needed to get transversal and parity invariance. And when the bison condenses, so I have written this down here. This is the phase where everything is gapped. That's the deconfined phase. When the bison condenses, when the bison condenses, you get the valence bond solid. Here, the bison and the spin-ons are both condensed, and here only the spin-on is condensed, as you can see from the signs. Anyway, and there's nothing, in the ABGM model, of course, supersymmetry guarantees you're at that point. Here, there's no such guarantee. That's a special point. Okay. Right. So now what I want to do, I guess I'm being all right with time, is take a little detour to some recent work, which will connect, the attempt of which is simply to unify this sort of seemingly disconnected approach to spin liquids to the other talks you've heard in this conference and present a unified theory of spin liquids. So I'm not going to unify all possible spin liquids, but I hopefully at least unify those that have been studied in MassAv in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and MIT at Harvard. Okay, so first, let me think about how... So the idea is exactly really, you have this electron which carries a number of quantum numbers. It has, of course, electromagnetic charge. It has spin. Now, not assuming that these are good symmetries of the Hamiltonian. They may be broken, but it's still useful to follow the fate of these global symmetries. Let's just think about the global symmetry, the SU2 spin. And then an electron also carries physical electromagnetic charge, which electron number, which I now call U1 subcharge. And on some lattices, the electron also has, there's also particle hole symmetry. and it's sometimes useful to, in fact, it's possible to combine the charge in the particle hole into a new SU2, which I call SU2 pseudo spin. So this also, you know, for example, the Hubbard model and the honeycomb or the square lattice has this symmetry. It has an additional SU2 pseudo spin symmetry at half filling. So, but let's just keep track of it, not necessarily assuming it's actually a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. All right, so let's keep track of these global symmetries. And the approach that I've presented in the first part of my talk, as I said, takes your electron and writes in terms of the new fermions that basically give you, that are oriented in the, which are measure the polarization of the local magnetic order. Plus minus is the spin projection across, along the local magnetic order. And Z is just telling you how the magnetic order is rotating. So in this factorization, how do all the charges act? Well, clearly, global SU2 spin is only carried by Zs, and you can see it corresponds to left multiplication over here. And the physical electromagnetic charge is carried by the size. That's a phase factor that goes through here and acts on psi plus and psi minus. And then you also see by this parameterization there's an emergent gauge invariance. And in general, in fact, that could be an SU2 gauge invariance because I can always insert a U and a U inverse in here, multiply this U inverse on the right and U on the left, and I get new Zs and psis, and I haven't changed anything. And so the theory that I write on for the Zs and psis, if they ever separate from each other, they will have to remember that they'll have this gauge charges. Now, that gauge symmetry could be Higgs in various ways, but it's gauge invariance. I shouldn't use the word symmetry. But anyway, so to keep track of this, so the theory for this, these type of spin liquids then most generally must have this SU2 gauge structure, and I call this SU2S gauge for reasons that will become obvious in a minute. All right, so now let me connect to, you know, works of, say, Matthew or Yongbae Kim or Xiaogang, and they're all ultimately based upon this sort of factorization, which is looks similar, but in detail is really very different, or seemingly different. So here you take your electrons, but now you're taking electron up and electron down dagger. And these are the spin-ons that Matthew or Yongbae talked about. And the spin indices go right through its F1 and F2 dagger. So now, in some sense, the SU2 spin is carried by these fermions. And so these are called the neutral fermionic spin-ons. And this rotation here, which is now originally due to Affleck et al., but used most, I guess this particular expression actually first in the paper of Wen and Li, is a rotation associated with what people have called slave bosons, or what Yongbae Kim called a slave rotor. They're basically all some version of B1 and B2. Okay. So here, and this is all motivated by the idea of projected fermion wave functions. Rather than starting from a magnetically ordered state that I started from in the first part of my talk, let's start from a free fermion system and then just gutfully project out the W occupied site. So for each different fermion wave function in potentially you're going to get different spin liquid states. And this is sort of an analytic way of doing that projection. The fluctuations of B, when integrated out, will project you down to singly occupied states of the spin-ons. So for this parameterization, let's ask how all these symmetries act. Well, the global symmetry of SU2, you know, the electromagnetic charge, and in fact the SU2 pseudo-spin is a left multiplication of this matrix. The SU2 spin is a left multiplication of the spin-ons because they just commute through the pseudo-spin. Spin and pseudo-spin commute with each other. And then finally, there's a gauge invariance, which acts in here in a very similar way to the previous discussion, and I call this SU2P comma gauge. So you can see if you just remember all these different things that I've written down here between this way of writing things and the other way, which is here, you keep track of it all. Basically, roughly what happens is that spin and pseudo-spin have interchanged places. In one case, the spin is carried by the fermion and the pseudo-spin by the bosons, and here it's the other way around. And in one case, you're gauging the spin transformation in a sense. In the other case, you're gauging the pseudo-spin transformation. That's really ultimately the difference. And so we said, well, there's a very natural way to unify all of this. Just take your fermion and write it in terms of real and imaginary parts. So they take the electron, write it in terms of chi 1 plus I chi 2 and chi 3 plus I chi 4. And now you have some new emergent fermion that will carry gate charges that are called zeta and an SO4 matrix R. And this is your electron is some SO4 matrix R times a real fermion zeta, each one of which are, everything here is real and has four components. R is a 4x4 matrix. Okay, so now if you ask how all the symmetries act, it's really very elegant and unified. The global symmetry just all act on the left, and it's SU2 pseudospin and SU2 spin. And then the theory has an O4 gauge invariance, which is just the tensor product of the two SU2 pseudosp gauge and SU2 S gauge that the two different camps in studying spin liquids have been studying. And so this seems like the most general way of putting together, a vast amount of previous work. So now you have this very rich gauge structure, and there's many different ways of breaking SO4 gauge, and this will give you all the different possibilities, at least a very rich set of possibilities of spin liquid phases with different types of topological order. And certainly in these the two approaches I mentioned, we can reproduce all of them without any trouble just by an appropriate factorization of this SO4 Higgs field. But we also find new examples. We find new phases, which I won't say anything more about, where you have Majorana fermion excitations, or these, which are neither spin-ons nor charge-ons. They only carry energy. So they're really truly fermionic excitations, which are almost impossible to see except in heat. But they do carry important topological information associated with the structure of the spin liquid phase. Okay, so that's really all I have to say here. There's a paper with Cheng Ke Zhu where we have we've listed a few of these examples on the honeycomb lattice, but we think the idea is much more general, and we'll give you as I said, it unifies many other approaches to spin liquids and may turn out to be in the most efficient language to talking about many of them in a common way. Yeah.
Which one?
The Higgs fields, the ones that keep...
Well, so there's some complicated Hamiltonian with lots of interactions. We can't solve it, but we can say, okay, let's assume the interaction somehow put you in a certain phase of the gauge here. Now, you can certainly get, you can get a Fermi liquid, no trouble. That the Fermi liquid is a Higgs phase where almost everything is condensed. That gives you a Fermi liquid. Or if you get a nail state, it's a different pattern of. So the confining conventional phases of solid state physics are certain types of Higgs phases. And then there are also spin liquid phases. And there's, of course, phases where nothing is Higgs, so that's like the parent phase. Okay. That's the mother of phases. and then you can get different daughters in different directions. And so we can do that. this doesn't include these very complicated spin liquid with non-abelian quasi particles and so on, but it does include a very wide class of spin liquids that has been studied for in the context of correlated electrons. Yeah.
Because, so, by this mechanism, do you increase now this class of variational wave functions?
Yes, yes. This is all very recent work, but it definitely should. So, it'd be interesting to rewrite this in terms of wave functions. That hasn't been done yet. Yeah. We've just been using a field theory language. There's definitely new candidates here. Yeah.
Sure, so you said that it does not include these spin liquids with non-abelian phase. But you have.
They may be here, but. I think some of the more complicated ones that Levitt and Wen and Nayak et al. Have studied are probably not here. But,
because you have Majorana fermion, so you can reproduce the physics of the Kitaev model.
Yeah, so we can certainly get, this is the Kitaev model I believe we already had in 1991, but yeah, this is getting more.
The issues of confinement and so on, how that gets realized in the context?
Well, they are the same issues here, of course. So you will need, in two dimensions, 2 plus 1, you will need some gapless states to prevent confinement if you have a continuous gate symmetry. If you break SO4 down to some discrete gate symmetry, then you can get confinement. You can get deconfined gating more easily.
Right.
Right. So they are, those are confinement, those issues are all very similar. You know, as Matthew and Greg Kim also discussed how it's confined. And 3+1 dimension, it's easier to get confined.
Can you get, well, can you even get, say, an SE2 one, or can you get all the quantum double, all the generalized Torah codes which have discrete?
Probably not. I don't know enough about that to make it categorical.
But I mean, if you say you expect the SF4 to SE2,
yeah,
then you'll have a leftover you'll have non-abelian spin liquid, or
You could certainly get a theory. Well, okay, in 2+1 dimensions, the SE2, you know, you would need some massless excitation to have a deconfined SE2 gauge field. But you can certainly break it down to other discrete subgroups very easily. And that's often enough. I mean, you know, the Z2 spin liquid state, you can write as a double chain Simons. It has the same topological structure as a double chain Simons U1 theory. But on the latitude, the actual quantum numbers that are carried by the excitation are only Z2.
Yeah, because that's what these general, I mean, it generalizes the Z2 to a discrete group, but then there's, I mean, it's this Dykraff-Witten theories. So there's no arc, there's sort of somehow like Chern Simons, but they're
All the simple ones are here. I mean, I think in particular, correct me wrong, Shaga, you know, the 100+ classification of spin liquids that Chaugang put forward, that's one subclass of this. Then to add to that, you have to add these boson X states that I talked about using quantum disordering nail states. But there are also some new ones that were neither class before. Okay, so how much time do I have? So
4 minutes.
4 minutes, okay. So now it's on real physics. So here I want to this is very conventional physics in a way. I want to talk about losing nail order, but previously I talked about losing nail order in the insulator. So here was the band structure I talked about earlier. Oops, now I've changed, I've gone from hot filling to some generic filling, and then no matter how much you turn up the nail order, you always get left with portions of the Fermi surface. But rather than looking at what happens here, I want to now look at actually right there, when you first induce nail order in a metal, not in an insulator. And this, is, I believe, is very relevant for many different compounds, including the cuprates. Okay, so in the 4 minutes remaining, I just want to tell you a little bit about what we know about the theory of the onset or the destruction of nail order in a Fermi liquid. So here there's no question of, well, naively, there's no question of integrating out the electrons because they're not gapped, unlike the first part of the talk where you had only filled bands once the nail order was strong enough. So here we just work with the electrons. This is the band structure of the electrons. You have your nail order parameter, and then you have this Yukawa-type coupling where you scatter your electrons by momentum K and multiply it by the scalar, by the nail order parameter here. Okay, so now this theory is, you know, of a form that nobody loves. It's not in a continuum limit that you can just turn up, open some field theory book. And it's also, but this part, it's a kind of a hybrid of solid state physics and field theory. So we have to massage it a little bit. And look at what are the low energy excitations. Well, here the famous hot spots I showed earlier offers one way to do it. So if you take your electron Fermi surface, which is right here, then this nail order parameter takes your electron from this point to that point. And it's only at these special hotspots that when you start from the Fermi surface, you end up on the Fermi surface. If you start somewhere else, you end up away from the Fermi surface. So that process is not important. It can be renormalized out because you have an intermediate high energy state. But this scattering process where you have a low energy spin fluctuation, it scatters an electron from here to there, has to be kept and is extremely important. So we expand about these 4 points and you get some velocities V1 and V2, which are normal to the Fermi surfaces, and you get a whole bunch of fermions with different indices, which I won't keep detailed track of. And once you expand, then you just focus on one pair of them. you can now move those points right on top of each other, rotate by 45 degrees, and then you get this very simple theory. You have two species of fermions, psi 1 and psi 2. One of them has velocity v1, the other has velocity v2. This is not a Dirac cone, this is x and y. And this is a Fermi line, and that's another Fermi line, and they're occupied as shown. Okay, and then the hot spot is that special point where in momentum space where the two lines intersect, which I put now at the origin, and these lines are sometimes called the cold Fermi lines. Okay, so this is, so now you have something that looks, you know, that's in the continuum. Look, it looks like Dirac fermions, but it's not Dirac fermions. Then you have a scalar field and have a Yukawa coupling. So now it's almost like the kind of thing that particle physicists work on. But because this is not a Dirac fermion, it's far, far more complicated. Now, one popular approach is the so-called Hertz theory. Okay, the Hertz theory, it says is that, well, even though I don't have a gap for the fermions, I don't care about them, so let me get rid of them. So if you do that, if you integrate out the fermions, now the presence of this, these lines and this hotspots means that you're going to get some long-range interactions. And the long-range interactions are in time, and the simplest approximation is this mod omega term, which is a 1 over tau squared interaction in imaginary time with the coefficient of dependence of velocities. And so then this looks like what, you know, string theory is now called Lipschitz scaling with z equals 2. But anyway, this is a low-energy approximation, and in fact, I think it's well understood by their work and our recent work that this is simply not correct in b equals 2. There are a number of higher-order terms you have to worry about. So you really have to work with the original theory, and we have a 50-page paper talking about the RG of this, and I won't say anything more about it. But now I just want to focus on one interesting feature of this. So you're going near this critical point where you're losing nail order. And so you get some interesting critical phenomena, but you get another thing, which is you get new types of orders that you didn't put in initially. We already saw an example of that in the first part of my talk. You started with this nail order, you wanted to get rid of it, and out came the valence bond solid. So is there an analog of that phenomenon here, where you get something you didn't put in, you try to go near a critical point, and some other type of ordering appears? But in fact, that's well known. There is one ordering that does appear here, and that is D-wave superconductivity. That is, this fermion will want to pair with this one, this will want to pair with that one, and the theory has a very important feature that the sign of the pairing here is opposite the sign of the pairing there. This goes back to early work of Scalapino, is well understood, and here's the continuum limit of it. And so what's happening here is that you have the fermion that with net zero momentum, this will get scattered to here, this will get scattered to there when you exchange the spin fluctuation. And for this to diverge, this ladder diagram, you need the opposite sign in the pairing amplitude. And so you get D-wave pairing. And the similar mechanism can be applied to the Nick tides with a more complicated Fermi surface. And there you get the S plus minus pairing, for which there is now beautiful scanning tunneling microscopy evidence. All right, so that's in some sense known, but we just have a fancier way of talking about it. But we found something new. Now, this theory, once you've taken all the continuum limits and written it down in this manner, has a pseudo-spin symmetry. The same old pseudo-spin that I introduced earlier, this becomes an exact symmetry of this continuum Lagrangian that I just wrote down. In fact, it's not just, it's more than a single pseudo-spin. For each pair of hotspots, you can take a different pseudo-spin matrix and rotate in this particle hole space. I mean, in fact, you can also do that on the Hubbard model on the honeycomb lattice, but there you have to do it in opposite directions on the two sublattices. You can only do it in one sublattice or the other. Let's say that. Anyway, but here you can do it differently on different hotspots. So now you can ask, you have this D-wave pairing instability represented by this pairing. Now, what if you do it on one pair of hotspots and not the other? Well, this just corresponds to particle hole transformation, so you just have to reverse this ladder, this thing. This is one hotspot, this is the other pair of hotspots. So now the claim is this particular channel, in the particle hole channel, is as divergent in this continuum theory, is as important as D-wave pairing, which we know is experimentally there, the biggest thing around. So what does this correspond to? So basically, it now is a particle hole instability, psi dagger psi and psi dagger psi. So that looks like a charge density wave of some type with a spin singlet instability. Now let me actually write it in the extended Brillouin zone scheme where I can move this point to that point. There we go. So now you see it's actually a rather small momentum instability along the diagonals. And furthermore, the pairing here or the of these two have to have the opposite sign of the pairing there. That's simply the consequence of the D. What was the D wave pairing becomes here kind of a higher angular momentum charge density wave. Anyway, so that's all well and good. Here's a picture of what it looks like. So this is my original square lattice, and you're getting, this is the analog of the valence bond solid appearing here. And this is a measure of the exchange energy or the pairing energy or the charge density on the bond. That's the thing that oscillates. Nothing happens on the sites. And what you see locally is this blue-red pattern. And remember, blue and red are plus or minus one. So locally, it's strong vertically and weak horizontally. But then when you go really far away, it's the opposite. So there's some global modulation, which is rather long wavelength. And locally, it has what people now call the Ising pneumatic character. And this is another version of it. But anyway, so I guess I'm not allowed to show experiments. But one possibility is that this has something to do, although this is just speculation at this point, to this kind of Ising pneumatic order that's seen in these STM experiments where they measured these colors, if you wish, using Skellington microscopy. They took the sum of A and B minus the sum of C and D. And that would be really large in this picture, in this region, but it would change sign when you went to these different regions. By square lattice symmetry, that should have random signs, only because of disorder. But as you see in this picture, it's basically all positive over this field of view. So locally, anyway, this emergent bond order that appears by the pseudo-spin transformation of D-wave superconductor looks like this. Anyway, so that's the end of my talk. This is the summary of what I just said. If you look at electrons near a spin density wave transition in a metal, then in fact, as this is not new, this is known and studied for many years, you get a D-wave superconductor, and you also get additional symmetries. Additional symmetry breaking, that's new, which may be connected to recent observations. It's also worth pointing that this mechanism for D-wave pairing gives you completely the right answer immediately in these new compounds, the nictite superconductor. And the summary of the first part of my talk was, well, I gave you an introduction to a different way of thinking about spin liquids, and then also unified them with the other spin liquids that you heard about. Thank you.
Time for a few short questions.
Yeah. This last part.
Yes.
I hope it's allowed to ask one of those questions about
please,
that part.
Yes, please, please.
Okay, so in your picture, the pneumatic order is a child of the magnetic order, and not of the charge order.
This is a charge, it's a bond charge density wave.
Right.
Yeah. Well, okay, yes. That's what this theory, yes, correct.
Right. Now, in the experiment,
yeah.
There is evidence for pneumatic order over a wide range.
Yeah.
Resulting in YVCO in particular.
Sure, sure.
And okay. There you see fluctuating stripes and all kinds of other things. So
yeah, okay.
How does it relate to that? I'm not saying this is incorrect, but what I'm saying is that there may be more physics.
Sure, so this is definitely a weak coupling perspective.
Right.
Yeah, and but I guess what I'm saying is that to the extent, if you're in a regime where pairing fluctuations make sense,
mm-hmm.
May not be strong, but that's also important in many of these regimes. Mm-hmm. The claim here is that in the same regime, this pneumatic order, it should be almost as important.
Okay.
It's as natural as D-wave pairing. That's all I'm saying at this point. Now, of course, but it's not global pneumatic, it's some other wave vector.
Mm-hmm.
And they're probably nonlinear. When you have all these, so we started with one instability, spin density wave, we found two more. And we can't separate them anymore. And now what you want, of course, the challenge is to work with all three and come up with a coherent theory. string theory will do that.
Okay, I'm going to actually suggest that we save the rest of the questions for lunch. It should be waiting for us outside. But let's thank Sue Berry again.